It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest is former Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell. Mitchell has made a career out of crafting compromise, first in the U.S. Senate, then later brokering peace in Northern Ireland, and finally as the U.S. Special Envoy for Middle East Peace. And tonight, Senator Mitchell will be speaking for the 11th Co-College Contemporary Issues Forum. That's at 7:30 in Sinclair Auditorium. He joins me now by phone. Wonderful to have you with us, Senator Mitchell.
Thank you, Ben. It's my pleasure.
Specifically, what contemporary issues do you plan to address in your talk?
Well, I generally rely upon the interest of the audience, so I leave plenty of time for questions and try not to talk the whole evening in my opening remarks. But generally, I like to cover both domestic and foreign policy issues. Since I had two tours of duty in the Middle East, people tend to be interested in my thoughts on what's occurring there now, both with respect to the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations that are underway and the U.S.-Europe negotiations with Iran. I also try to take a little bit of a look into the future. We seem to be so pressed with immediate demands and challenges that I don't think we give enough thought to or planning for the future. And so I'll talk a little bit about the future both here in our country and abroad.
Okay. Let's delve into some of those themes. Let's start with Iran. After Iran and the major powers signed into an interim deal on Tehran's nuclear program, expectations have been high. Recently, though, expectations have dimmed. Iranian officials have made some, some pretty tough public comments. Israel's prime minister has reaffirmed his opposition to almost any conceivable idea. And also a skepticism shared by a number of influential U.S. senators. How do you see the main obstacles to a deal in the case of Iran and its nuclear program?
Well, the challenge really is one for the government and the people of Iran. The Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme ruler in Iran, has said that Iran does not seek a nuclear weapon. In fact, he said it's against the teachings of the Quran. The incoming president of Iran has said the same thing with respect to their objectives. The problem, of course, is that the actions of their government have been inconsistent with those statements. Iran is a participant, a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Agreement, and therefore subject to inspections. And the inspectors have repeatedly said that Iran has not been accurate or truthful in its statements, and it has not complied with its obligations under that agreement. So I think that the real challenge will be whether the people of Iran and their government make sure their actions conform to the public statements of the supreme ruler and the president, and that, in fact, they are not seeking a nuclear weapon. The interim agreement entered into and now in place was intended to permit detailed negotiations to reach a permanent and final agreement. I think it was the right thing for the United States to do. Obviously, there are differing points of view, but I think that it would have been extremely unwise for the president to reject this approach and would have undermined the entire effort. So I don't happen to agree with the critics on this issue. I'll be glad to get into that in more detail if you'd like.
Mm-hmm. Yes, specifically in his State of the Union address, the president said he would veto any bill that had further sanctions on Iran at this point, and it seems that you would agree with that action as well.
Yeah, I do agree with the president on that, and there are a lot of reasons for that. The first and most important one is that it's clear that Iran is now at the table because the sanctions are having an effect. The sanctions are having an effect primarily because they are universal. They are not U.S.-only sanctions. Experience has shown over the past several decades that when sanctions are by one or a few countries, they are not effective. When they are universal and all countries observe them, then they are effective, and that's the case in Iran today. Well, there is no evidence whatsoever to suggest that if the sanctions are increased at this point, or legislation is passed to impose new sanctions at a specific time in the future, depending on what the agreement says, that Russia and China will go along with those increased sanctions. In fact, all of history and the evidence suggests just the opposite. So enacting this legislation now very likely would transform the sanctions from universal to U.S. sanctions and thereby undermine the very effectiveness of the thing that these people say they want to increase. To me, that doesn't make any sense at all. Secondly, the real issue is whether there can be a permanent agreement. We're never going to find out unless we have a negotiation for that purpose. For the Congress to say, well, here's what we want you to do, and if you don't get this result, we're going to increase sanctions, kind of puts the cart before the horse. Let's see what the negotiation produces. Let's see if Iran makes the critical decision that I think is necessary in its own interest not to seek a nuclear weapon, because I think the consequences will be drastic for them if they do, and then criticize. But to try to impose a requirement that says we want the negotiations to produce this result, just the way we want it, and if it doesn't produce that result, we want to take all these other steps, to me, doesn't make any sense at all if you're really interested in getting this job done.
As a former high-level negotiator, Senator Mitchell, what do you see in the fact that there is this mismatch between what has been spoken in Tehran recently and the interim agreement? Does that lead you to believe that there's a different agenda than is being stated by Iran's leaders?
Well, in fact, of course, it's very common in negotiations for people to stake out tough positions, either at the beginning of the talks or even during the talks in public statements. I encounter that every day for 5 years in Northern Ireland and every day in my two tours of duty in the Middle East back in 2000, 2001, and again between 2009 and 2011. There's nothing unusual about that. There are domestic politics in every society. There are hardliners and those who want to proceed in Iran. In this country, there are those who think that the best way forward is just to up the sanctions and somehow Iran will cave in and do exactly what we want. I don't have to think that's right. So in dealing with domestic political differences, governments and leaders all over the world routinely stake out tough positions and in the negotiations themselves. In Northern Ireland, I once said that I was there for, and the main negotiation lasted about 2 years, about 700 days, and for 699 days, both parties said what they wouldn't do. On the last day, when we reached an agreement, both did what they had been saying for 2 years they wouldn't do. I mean, if there weren't disagreements, you wouldn't be having a negotiation.
Let's touch briefly, if we could, on with your thoughts on Syria, currently the largest humanitarian crisis in the world, that civil war causing that crisis, the sides showing no sign of negotiating a peace. Briefly, what do you see as the biggest obstacles to peace in Syria? Is it intractable?
Well, there are many obstacles to peace, beginning, of course, with the government. In my judgment, its policies have been horrific, and its actions in launching attacks on its own people. I don't believe that there is any realistic way that the current government can remain in authority. I think it's lost all semblance of legitimacy as a result of this conflict. At the same time, the alternatives are going to have problems of their own. It's a fact of history, which we can't ignore, that very frequently when despotic governments have been overturned by revolution, they've been replaced by something worse or something just as bad. Russia is the best, most obvious example of that. For centuries, they were oppressed by the Tsars, but not many people would argue that the murderous regime of Joseph Stalin was an improvement. So you see that over and over again. The second is that it's a turbulence that's occurring throughout the region because you have an intersection of several conflicts coming together at one time in that part of the world. First, you have the Sunni-Shia divide, which has existed for 1,300 years since the beginning of Islam. It's intensifying now and is contributing to and being accelerated by the conflict in Syria, spreading throughout the region, indeed into Pakistan and other areas. Secondly, you have the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Third, you have the Persian-Arab hostility, which is ancient in nature. And fourth, and just as important, you have all across the region the inability of governments to meet the basic needs of their people. These are human beings. They want jobs, good education, good health care, a good chance in life for their children. This isn't just about religion, although that's a huge factor. But everywhere, these large populations, rapidly growing populations, the governments haven't been able to meet their needs, and so there is a restlessness, a desire for change among the people. Unfortunately, and as Egypt is the case, the revolution rolls on and the economy keeps going down.
If you just joined us, my guest is former Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell. He'll be speaking tonight at Coe College for the 11th Coe College Contemporary Issues Forum, 7:30 at Sinclair Auditorium. Senator Mitchell made history while chairing peace negotiations in Northern Ireland, work that culminated in the Good Friday Agreement, for which he was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Continuing on with the Middle East, in May of 2011, you resigned as chief of the United States envoy to the Israelis and Palestinians with some growing frustration over the impasse in the peace talks. What circumstances made you finally throw in the towel?
When the president asked me to undertake this assignment in early 2009, just before he was inaugurated, I said to him, I've just spent 5 years in Northern Ireland, and I can't spend 5 years in the Middle East. I can only do a limited period of time. He said, well, how long can you do? I said, I'll commit to 2 years. I said, but after that, I've got to take a look at it. And so I did 2.5 years. So it was in accordance with my initial discussion and understanding with the president. A factor was, of course, that prospects looked bleak at the time. They were very difficult. We had gotten the parties together. There had been talks between the Prime Minister of Israel and the President of the Palestinian Authority. They met four times in September of 2010. I was present at all of those meetings, and they just didn't work out as we had hoped. Rather than gaining traction and moving forward, they moved further apart, and then those talks ended. So I now commend very much Secretary of State John Kerry for the effort that he's making, and I hope and pray that it will produce an agreement.
I believe your father was a son of Irish immigrants. Your mother emigrated from Lebanon. And so you're negotiating a peace in Northern Ireland and your efforts in the Middle East. I wonder if you draw on some of your heritage during your work with these regions, knowing the cultural differences.
No, that really had no effect on me whatsoever. My father's parents were born in Ireland, but he never knew his parents. He was raised in an orphanage. His mother died, and his father couldn't care for the children. So, and then he was adopted by an elderly couple from Maine, who were not of Irish heritage. So my father really never knew much about Ireland. He didn't have any education. He worked as a laborer and a janitor. So he never went to Ireland. I never heard him say the word. So that had no effect on me whatsoever. Mm. Likewise, my mother. My mother was a Maronite Catholic family in Lebanon, many of whom emigrated to the United States. She came at the age of 18. She was illiterate in English, and she went to work in a textile mill as a teenager, where she spent most of her life. And their whole, objective in life was assimilation and education. Their goal in life was that their children would get the education they never had, and I'm one of five, and we all did graduate from college. So there wasn't much talk about the past. In my father's case, he knew nothing about the past. Most of the talk was on the future in this country, and my parents' motto was pretty simple: work hard, study hard, and get an education.
Now, let's talk about the domestic front. Washington, more divided by partisanship than it has been in decades. How different, how would you describe the difference in the climate in Washington now from when you were Senate Majority Leader from 89 to 95?
I thought it was tough then, but it's obviously much worse now. On the day that I was elected Senate Majority Leader, one of the first persons I called was Bob Dole, the Republican leader. I went to see him, and I said, these are very tough jobs, and I don't think we can, either of us, can succeed if we don't have some degree of trust between us. So I said, I've come to tell you how I intend to behave toward you and ask you to behave the same way toward me. He was delighted, and we shook hands on pretty simple and basic standards of fairness. I told him I wouldn't surprise him, I wouldn't criticize him personally, would try to stay on the merits of all the many issues we disagree on. And to this day, to this moment, there has never been a harsh word between Bob Dole and I, in public or in private. We became and we remain very good friends. Still, it was tough. There were a lot of disagreement, a lot of haggling. The Senate's not an easy place to work in, and certainly not an easy place to manage. But I think now, with increased gerrymandering, with the tremendous amount of money flowing into the political system and really distorting our political process and severing the bond of trust that has to exist between the people and their elected representatives, I think it's much, much harder.
I wonder if you think that the problem that our current is the problem that our current leaders in Washington are just not very good at finding common ground, or more the case, as you were describing, that the climate is so partisan it doesn't allow compromise even when there are people of goodwill, trust, and civility?
I think part of the reason is that economic times are tough. If you go back over history, politics has always been rough in our country. There never was a golden era in which everybody got along and never disagreed and never had conflict. I read a recent article in a Maine newspaper about the election of 1800, in which the exchanges between supporters of Thomas Jefferson, the challenger, and John Adams, the incumbent president, were very sharp and harsh. But, of course, you didn't have electronic media then. Those were words written and read by very few, distant in time and location. Nowadays, you have the ubiquity and the power of electronic communication, particularly television, and the conducive nature it has to the negative approach to politics, you know, the 30-second attack ad. And you combine that with the absolute cascade of money into the system, which turns elected office into just a continuing frantic chase for money, I think it has made it very, very difficult. The problem has been there forever. I don't think there's been a country in the history of the world where money and organization haven't played a role in determining how leaders are chosen or who they are. But in this country, I think it's gotten really way out of hand, and unfortunately, I think, given the recent Supreme Court decisions, it's likely to get worse.
In the couple minutes that we have remaining, I wondered if you could touch on one of the items that you said you'd be talking about tonight at Coe College, future planning. What do you mean by that? We've got a couple minutes. Elaborate a little bit, please.
Well, you look at the Middle East now, and people say, oh my gosh, it's terrible. When's it going to get better? Well, it isn't going to get better anytime soon, because if you look at the most recent UN population projections, there are now about 7 billion people on Earth. The first billion, it took 1,800 years following the birth of Christ to get to 1 billion. The 7th billion, the most recent, occurred in 13 years. And it's continuing. Population is expected to peak between 9.5 and 10 billion people in the middle of this century. And most of that growth will occur in less developed and undeveloped countries. A lot of it in the Middle East and in Africa. And it's going to mean the demands for water, land, natural resources, economic, political power will grow. And so circumstances, I think, are going to get tougher, particularly with the increasing intensity of the Sunni-Shia conflict. So I think it's going to be a rough period of time ahead. But I think there's also great promise and opportunity for the United States, and I'll be discussing that tonight.
Perhaps you can leave us with, since you are so well known as a negotiator at such a high level, I wonder if you can leave us with some thoughts about finding common ground, negotiating agreement, whether it happens to be Northern Ireland, the Middle East, or a disagreement that may erupt at the kitchen table.
Well, I think the most important thing is learning to listen, to actually pay attention to and to give consideration to the views of those who disagree with us and in whom we're engaged in a negotiation. Second, to have some degree of patience and perseverance. People need to talk their way through issues. The negotiations in Northern Ireland, I was there for 5 years. I chaired three separate sets of discussions. The reporters asked me after we got the agreement, well, you set a deadline and an agreement occurred. Why didn't you set a deadline years ago? My answer was, if I'd set a deadline years ago, there wouldn't have been an agreement. You have to have the right sense of timing. So you have to have some degree of patience and perseverance, and you have to try throughout it to retain some level of respect for those with whom you disagree. It's very easy in this country now, particularly in campaigns, to go around insulting your opponents, making extravagant, inflammatory statements. That's one thing for campaigning, but it's hard to govern when you have to compromise with the same people you've been insulting in a campaign. So I think it calls for all of those things, plus a heavy dose of humility, understanding and accepting that no one person, no one party, no one side has a monopoly on good intentions, good judgment, and the right answers to the issues.
Senator George Mitchell, you've been very generous with your time. Thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you. It's a pleasure, and I look forward to seeing you.
Okay, Senator Mitchell will speak tonight at Coe College at 7:30 at Sinclair Auditorium. Thank you again, Senator.
How is technology changing the way we read and think? Coming up after a short break, Nicholas Carr. Carr is a technology, culture, and economics writer whose work has appeared in many publications, including The Atlantic, The New York Times, and The Wall Street Journal. His most recent book, The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, was a 2011 Pulitzer Prize nominee and a New York Times bestseller. Thursday, he'll be speaking at Luther College in Decorah. So after a short break, I'll talk with him about how all these devices we use to learn about the world and to interact with each other are changing our thinking. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.